From the studios of 2RPH in Sydney, this is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome to this week. Well, 30 Laps this week is a bit more of the macabre. We look at a couple of vehicles that were connected to our previous program in December last year about JFK and that wonderful Lincoln Continental. Linked and that the occupants got into the back seat but did not get out alive. One that had serious, deadly, heartbreaking consequences, and its echoes were felt right around the world. The actions of one man who could well be one of the most pivotal people of the 20th century, someone who changed the course of history, one of the most talked about men in modern history that you may never have heard of, or at least his name anyway. And the other? Well, the other was just plain sad, and it robbed us of one of the great music makers of the day. The first car had a career of bad luck and death followed it, and the second didn't. Well, as usual, it's all here on 30 Laps this week. So this week, the Graf and Stift double Phaeton and the shiny blue Cadillac. So let's get cracking, shall we? From the SmithsonianMag.com, written in 2013 by Mike Dash, curses Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his astounding death car. It's hard to think of another event in the troubled 20th century that had quite the shattering impact of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, June 28, 1914. The Archduke was heir to the throne of the tottering Austro-Hungarian Empire. His killers, a motley band of amateurish students, were Serbian nationalists, or possibly Yugoslav nationalists, historians remain divided on that score, who wanted to turn Austrian-controlled Bosnia, into a part of the new Slav state. The guns and bombs they used to kill the Archduke, meanwhile, were supplied by the infamous Colonel Apis, head of the Serbian military intelligence. All of this was quite enough to provoke Austria-Hungary into declaring war on Serbia. After which, with the awful inevitability that A.J.P. Taylor famously described as war by timetable, Europe slid inexorably into the horrors of the First World War, as the rival great powers began to mobilise against one another. To say that all is well known is an understatement. I have dealt with the stranger aspects of the story before in another article, Past Imperfect, seen from the historian's perspective, though even the most familiar of the events of that day have interesting aspects that often go unremarked. The appalling combination of implausible circumstance that resulted in assassination is one. Franz Ferdinand had survived an early attempt to kill him on the fateful day, emerging unscathed from an explosion of a bomb that bounced off the folded roof of his convertible and exploded under a car following him behind in his motorcade. That bomb injured several members of the imperial entourage, and those men were taken to hospital. It was Franz Ferdinand's impulsive decision later in the day to visit them there, a decision none of his assassins could have predicted, that took him directly past the spot where his assassin, Gavrilo Princip, was standing. It was chauffeur Leopold Jolka's unfamiliarity with the new route that led him to take the wrong turn and, confused, pulled to a halt, just 6 feet from the gunman. For the Archduke to be presented as a stationary target to the one man in a crowd of thousands still determined to kill him was a remarkable stroke of bad luck. But even then, the odds still favoured Franz Ferdinand's survival. Princip was so hemmed in by the crowd, he was unable to pull out and prime the bomb he was carrying. Instead, he was forced to resort to his pistol, but failed to actually aim it. According to his own testimony, Princip confessed, "Where I aimed, I do not know," adding that he had raised his gun against the automobile without aiming. "I even turned my head as I shot." Even allowing for the point-blank range, it's pretty striking, given these circumstances, that the killer fired just two bullets. Yet one struck Franz Ferdinand's wife, Sophie, who was sitting alongside him, and the other hit the heir to the throne himself. It is astonishing that both rounds proved almost immediately fatal. Sophie was hit in the stomach and her husband in the neck, the bullet severing his jugular vein. There was nothing any doctor could have done to save either of them. There are strange aspects to the events of June 28th than this, however. The assassination proved so momentous that it is not surprising that there were plenty of people ready to say afterward that they had seen it coming. One of them, according to an imperial aide, was the fortune teller who had apparently told the Archduke he would one day let loose a world war. That story carries a tang of after the effect for me, who, before August 14, spoke in terms of a world war, I don't know. A European war, perhaps. Yet it seems pretty well established that Franz Ferdinand himself had premonitions of an early end. In the account of one relative, he had told some friends the month before his death that, "I know I shall soon be murdered." A third source has the doomed man extremely depressed and full of forebodings. A few days before the assassination took place. According to yet another story, Franz Ferdinand had every reason to suppose he was about to die. This legend, not found in history books, but, says the London Times, preserved as an oral tradition among Austria's huntsmen, records that in 1913 a heavily armed archduke had shot a rare white stag, and adds that it was widely believed of any hunter who killed such an animal that he or she or a member of his or her family shall die within a year. The archduke was a keen, if indiscriminate, hunter, seen with a singles day bag quite often many, many animals. There is nothing inherently implausible in this legend, or at least not in the idea that Franz Ferdinand might have mown down a rare animal without thinking twice about it. The Archduke was a committed and indiscriminate huntsman, whose personal record when in pursuit of small game was 2,140 kills in a day. And who, according to the records he meticulously compiled in his own game book, had been responsible for the deaths of a grand total of 272,439 animals. Jeepers. During his lifetime. The majority of which had been loyally driven straight forward and toward him by numerous assemblies of beaters. But of all the tall tales that attached themselves to Franz Ferdinand after his death, the best known and most widely circulated concerns the car, and this is where we come in, folks, at 30 laps, in which he was driven to his death. The vehicle, a Grafenstedt double phaeton, built by the Graf brothers of Vienna, who had been bicycle manufacturers only a few years earlier, had been made in 1910. And was owned not by the Austro-Hungarian state, but by Count Franz von Harrach, an officer of the Austrian Army Transport Corps, who apparently lent it to the Archduke for his day in Sarajevo. According to this legend, von Harrach's vehicle was so cursed by either its involvement in the awful events of June 1914, or perhaps its gaudy, blood-red paint job, that pretty much every subsequent owner met a hideous final destination sort of end. You're with Richard Lyon, 30 Laps with Dick, and we're right into the macabre of the assassination of Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo. The Austrian heir and his wife Sophie came from an aristocratic Bohemian family, but were not royal. Their Morganatic marriage was the cause of considerable controversy and uncertainty in Austria-Hungary. Lots of suspicious minds, I think.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing?
Quite possibly could have been playing on the radio at that time of the day for them both. But I digress. It's sensible to point out first that the story of the cursed death car did not begin to make the rounds until decades after Franz Ferdinand's death. It dates, so far as I have been able to establish, to 1959, when it was popularised in Frank Edwards' Stranger Than Science. This is not a terribly encouraging discovery. Edwards, a hack writer who wrote a series of sensational books recounting paranormal staples across one or two pages of purple prose, rarely offered his readers anything so persuasive as an actual source. He was prone to exaggeration and untroubled by the outright invention. To make matters worse, Edwards wrote up the story of the jinxed Gruff and Stutt at pretty much the same time that a very similar tale concerning James Dean's cursed Porsche spider had begun to make the rounds in the United States. It would be unfair, however, to hold Edward solely responsible for the popularity of the death car legend. In the decades since he wrote, the basic tale accumulated additional detail, as urban legends tend to do. So that by 1981, the Weekly World News was claiming that the blood-red Grafenstutt was responsible for more than a dozen deaths. Pared down to its elements, the news version of the story, which still makes the rounds online, tells the story of the worlds of the 1940s Vienna museum curator named Karl Brunner, and it opens with him refusing to allow visitors to climb into the infamous haunted car. That was one of his prize exhibits. The remainder of the account runs like this. After the armistice, the newly appointed governor of Yugoslavia had the car restored to first-class condition. But after four accidents and the loss of his right arm, he felt the vehicle should be destroyed. His friend, Dr. Shrikas, disagreed, scoffing at the notion that a car could be cursed. He drove it happily for 6 months, till the overturned vehicle was found on the highway with a doctor's crushed body beneath it. Another doctor became the next owner, but when his superstitious patients began to desert him, he hastily sold it to a Swiss race driver. In a road race in the Dolomites, the car threw him over a stone wall, and he died of a broken neck. A well-to-do farmer acquired the car, which stalled one day on the road to market. While another farmer was towing it for repairs, the vehicle suddenly growled into full power and knocked a tow car aside in a careening crash down the highway. Both farmers were killed. Tibo Hirschfeld, the last private owner, decided that all the old car needed was a less sinister paint job. He had it repainted in a cheerful blue shade and invited five friends to accompany him to a wedding. Hirschfeld and four of his guests died in a gruesome head-on collision. By this time, the government had had enough. They shipped the rebuilt car to a museum. But one afternoon, Allied bombers reduced the museum to smoking rubble. Nothing was found of Karl Brunner or the haunted vehicle. Nothing, that is, but a pair of dismembered hands clutching a fragment of a steering wheel. It's a nice story. And the wonderful suggestive detail in the last sentence that Brunner had finally succumbed to the temptation to climb behind the wheel himself, and in doing so drew down a 1,000-pound bomb onto his head, is a neat touch. But it's rubbish. To begin with, many of the details are plain wrong. Princip did not leap onto the running board of the Grafenstadt, and as we have seen, he certainly didn't pump bullet after bullet into his victims. Nor did Yugoslavia have a governor after 1918. It became a kingdom. And while it's true that Franz Ferdinand's touring car did make it to a Vienna museum, the military museum there, as a matter of fact, it wasn't destroyed by bombing in the war. It's still on display today and remains one of the museum's main attractions. The Grafenstadt touring car that drove Franz Ferdinand to his death can still be seen on display in Austria's Heeriger Schießerlich Museum in Vienna. Note the conspicuous absence of the vehicle's fabled blood-red paint job. The car is not painted blood-red. It displays no sign of any damage caused by a long series of ghastly road accidents and head-on collisions. It does still bear the scars of the bombs and the bullets of the 28th of June, however. And that seems pretty odd for a vehicle that must be, at the very least, undergone a top-to-tail restoration on three occasions for the death legend to be true. There's no evidence whatsoever, in short, that the vehicle ever suffered through the bloody experiences attributed to it by Frank Edwards and those who copied him. And although I can find no indication that anyone has ever done a full-fledged reinvestigation of Edwards' original tale, there's no sign in any of the more reputable corners of my library or online or any Tiber Hirschfeld or any Simon Mathuridis, a bloody deceased diamond merchant who crops up in several variants across the tale, nor a dead Vienna Museum curator called Karl Brunner. All of these names can be found solely in recountings of the legend itself. In closing, though, I want to draw attention to an even more outstanding coincidence concerning Franz Ferdinand's death limo, one that is considerably better evidenced than the cursed car nonsense. This tiny piece of history went completely unremarked for the best part of a century, until a British visitor named Brian Preslin called it Vienna's unpronounceable museum's name, where the vehicle is now on display. It was Preslin who seemed to have first drawn the staff's attention to the remarkable detail contained in the Grafenstadt's license plate, which reads A111118. That number, Preslin pointed out, is capable of a quite astonishing interpretation. It can be taken to read, for instance, A for armistice 11/11/18, which means that the death car has always carried with it a prediction not only of the dreadful day of Sarajevo, that in a real sense marked the beginning of the First World War, but of November 11, 1918, Armistice Day, the day the war ended. This coincidence is so incredible that I initially suspected it might be a hoax, that perhaps the Grafenstadt had been fitted with a plate retrospectively. A couple of things that suggest this, not the case, however. First, the pregnant meaning of the initial A applies only in English. The German for armistice is Waffenstillstand, a satisfyingly Teutonic-sounding mouthful that literally translates us as arms stand still. And Austro-Hungary did not surrender on the same day as its German allies. It had been knocked out of the war a week earlier, on November 4, 1918. So the number plate is a little less spooky in its native country. And so far as I can make it out, it also contains not five number ones, but three capital I's and two numbers. Perhaps, then, it's not quite so perplexing that the museum director, buttonholed by Brian Preslin, said he had worked in the place for 20 years without spotting the plate's significance. More important, however, a contemporary photo of the fateful limousine, taken just as it turned into the road where a Garolivo Princip was waiting for it, some 30 seconds before Franz Ferdinand's death, shows the car bearing what looks very much like the same number plate as it does today. You're going to have to take my word for this. The plate is just visible, in the best quality copy of the image that I have had access to, and I've been able to read it with a magnifying glass. But my attempts to scan this tiny detail in high definition have been unsuccessful. I'm satisfied, though, and while I don't pretend that this is anything but a quite incredible coincidence, it certainly is credible, one of the most jaw-dropping I've ever come across. And it resonates. It makes you wonder what that bullet-headed old stag murderer Franz Ferdinand might have made of it, had he any sight of imagination at all. And that was an interesting story, wasn't it, hey? From the Smithsonian magazine, smithsonianmag.com, by Mike Dash, curses Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his astounding death car. I guess you could say in Elvis Presley terms, it was all on the edge of reality.
Darling, dark shadows follow me. Here's where life's dream lies disillusioned, the edge of reality.
Oh, all those spies beware. This is Richard Lyon, 30 Laps of Dick. We're 21 minutes into our journey, and we're going to go from death cars, which I think we've had enough of today. We might do the second part of the death car on another day, back to the reality of the rising land of the rising Datsun. And this comes from Tony Davis in the Life and Leisure section of the Australian Finance Review on the 9th of February 2020. He writes, The collectible car market has been stunned by an original Datsun selling in the United States for more than $310,000 US. It wasn't even a particularly rare model, but a stock standard 240Z, the company's two-seater affordable sports car of the early 1970s. More than 160,000 of this model were made, of which 2,358 were shipped to Australia back in the day. The sale price, achieved via the online auction site bringatrailer.com, came just 7 months after a US $124,240 sale, also in America, set a new benchmark for the 240Z. But it doesn't mean local Z car owners are suddenly sitting on gold mines, says Charles Borribun of the Australian collectible car auction house Shannons. That was an exceptional car with an unusual provenance and low mileage, he says. But it was also an original as new condition and had been owned by the same family since 1971, travelling just 21,000 miles, which is 33,800 Australian kilometres. Nonetheless, Borribun says the early Zeds are appreciating well in Australia. A really nice 240 in today's market, fully restored with correct matching numbers, is between $60,000 and $80,000. There is a general increase in interest across the brands, he adds. We've seen the 60s and 70s, and now we're seeing the 80s and 90s special model Japanese cars coming into their own. 40 and 50-year-olds have the money to potentially buy these cars they weren't able to buy new. Borribun says stars include the original Honda NSX from 1990 onwards, examples from the original batch of 100 Skyline GTR R32s imported here in 1991 and, ironically, sold poorly at the time, and even the two-door Subaru WRX STI from the late 1990s. The most sought-after NSXs can fetch up to $200,000, said Borribun, which is at the very top end for second-hand Japanese cars. Internationally, the holy grail is the Toyota 2000 GT, of which just 351 were built by Yamaha on behalf of Toyota, between 67 and 70. One example of this rare coupe has fetched US 1.2 million. Perhaps the only other Japanese sports car in that league is an even more rare high-performance car based on the 240Z, a 1970 Nissan Fairlady Z432R sold at a Tokyo auction for US$805,700. So there we go. Land of the Lies. Got it wrong the second time. Land of the Rising Datsun. It was written by Tony Davis out of the Australian Financial Review. Life and Leisure. We've got time just for a couple more. Where did they get that emblem from? And we started off last week in the A's, and we're still in the A's, with Alpina. The name Alpina derives from the company's first shop, which produced, of course, typewriters, by the Alps. The imagery on the badge is a Weber carburetor, a component that began the company's close relationship with BMW, and a crankshaft. I thought they might have had a typewriter in there somewhere. But next to Alpina, we have Aston Martin. The second half of the name comes from one of the company's co-founders, Lionel Martin, the first from the Aston Hill Club competition, which he found success at. The wing's badge was chosen in 1927 to represent speed and supposedly took inspiration from the Bentley's winged bee. And that's about all we have time for this week in our death-defying episode. I hope you've learned a little bit more about the man who pulled the trigger that started the dreadful First World War and the car that his victims were driving in when he did pull that trigger. We'll do a country and western vehicle of the very same sort of scenario very shortly. I hope you can, if you've got a 260Z under a tarpaulin in a garage somewhere, you can run out after listening to this and pull the covers off and see if you've become an instant millionaire. It's hard to believe that they're worth that so much money. But I guess anything in original condition with low kilometres is. Thank you too to Elvis Presley, who made a brief appearance, and I dare say he'll probably make appearances in later episodes. The show is written and produced in the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. I'm Richard Lyon. I've had a lot of fun, as usual, bringing this show to you, and I look forward to talking to you again very soon. And until then, stay safe. Talk soon. Bye for now. Thank you.